Good morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. And don't forget, we're moving up the dial to 101.1 FM. And for the next few months, we're simulcasting with 90.7 FM and 101.1. 101.1 FM will be our new home, Santa Fe Public Radio. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to some of the residents from the Santa Fe Art Institute, and we're going to be speaking to Christy Wickman of the Women's Health Services about some of the programs that are coming up there. Right now, I would like to welcome Ulla Peterson. She's from the Kindred Spirits Animal Sanctuary, and Carol Olson, who is an artist. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
And we're here to talk about the Kindred Spirits Animal Sanctuary and the upcoming Summer Benefit Art Show, which is on Saturday. It's this Saturday coming up.
Yes, it is. Saturday, the 28th.
The 28th from 10 to 4, and it's at the Animal Sanctuary, and we'll be talking more about that in a moment. But this is a very, very interesting place. It's a place for elder care and hospice for animals. How did you start doing this work?
Okay. Well, first of all, I'm a nurse and I'm also a bereavement counselor, and I came to realize that in the animal rescue community there was a real special need for the elderly animals. And this culture being such a throwaway, having such a throwaway mentality that that a lot of the elderly companion animals in our community suffered that fate. And also people often just don't understand the care that an elderly animal needs. And so between the two, I realized that there was a real special need there, and that that I didn't see anyone doing, really. So I thought, well, let's focus on that.
When you say throwaway culture, do you find that people actually don't want their animals? They just want to get a new puppy when their dog gets old? I mean, that's horrifying.
It is. It is.
Is it true?
It is true. It happens a lot. It certainly, you know, is not the majority of people, but it does happen a lot, unfortunately. And I know that the people that work in animal rescue, in shelters and so forth, see it all the time. Some of the animals are brought back to the shelters, and many are simply just dumped on our roads and anywhere they can be disposed of, out of sight, basically. Many people do that in order to get a younger animal and maybe a different color, a different type, that sort of thing. And yes, it is.
I wonder if it's the same kind of person that dumps their spouse for a younger one.
Could be. I haven't done research on that. Could be, yeah.
So how do you come by these animals, and how do you choose? I mean, you've got a limited amount of space, and there's so many animals that need rescuing, as regular listeners of the show know. How do you choose which ones to bring into Kindred Spirits?
Uh-huh. We have an admission criteria, and certainly one of them is that they have to be quite advanced in age, and they also have to have no other resources whatsoever. So we rarely take in from private individuals. We try and do a lot of counseling instead and find situations within the family or neighbors and so forth that can take over.
So somebody will call you and say, I have an old animal, I don't want it anymore, and then you'll have a conversation with them?
Right, we do. There can also, of course, be other situations where their guardian has died or has severe illness, that sort of thing. And that's certainly very understandable that, you know, somebody will have to take over the care of the animals. However, we try and really work with the family and neighbors and so forth. And often people just need to stretch a little longer. And, you know, these things in life are not always, quote, convenient.
And well, you grew up in Denmark. We were talking the other day, and we're talking about how different your sense of aging was, both for animals and for human beings, having grown up in the house with grandparents.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And We have more of a sense, I guess, or at least at that time in history, that's quite some years ago, that all the phases of life is very important. And aging is something that we think of as we think of our older people in a very honorable way, and we treat them that way with respect and care, and we realize that they have a lot to offer too, to pass on to us, and just their way of being in the world that they see with very different eyes and values than us, you know, younger and inexperienced ones. So there's a lot to be gained to revere and really value our older people or animals too, and also be supportive if they're ailing or if they're frail, whatever, to support them as they supported the younger ones too, you know.
We're talking to Ulla Peterson of the Kindred Spirits Animal Sanctuary. So there are some very grisly and sad abandonment stories. Tell us some of the stories of that you've seen of animals being abandoned here in New Mexico.
Yeah. We get many calls every day from people that find animals. We specifically, our sanctuary is specifically set up to care for elderly dogs and horses and poultry also. These are the animals that I'm most familiar with myself, that I know the best, and unfortunately we're not set up to care for cats. However, we get a lot of calls every day. We do have limitations on how many we can take. So saying no is one of the very, very hard parts of the work, because I know those animals have no place to go. They will probably end up being euthanized because there is no home for them. But many have suffered severe abuse, physical, emotional, mental abuse. We have one senior resident who is a survivor of having been a bait dog in dog fighting.
Salvador the pit bull.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great dog.
He is. He is wonderful. And somehow, and this is tremendous inspiration in my work, somehow, in spite of all his suffering and all his disabilities, he's been able to change or to turn a page and to go forward and to open his heart. And he is just radiant with love and light and affection.
And his front legs are irreparably damaged.
Right, right. As are many other parts of his body. He's had a lot of broken bones, and he was severely depressed and so forth when he first came. And what we find repeatedly is that once these animals that have suffered so much, once they feel safe, and we continue to assure them that they really are with us for the rest of their life. This is their last station. They are not going to be adopted out. They would not do well. They begin to try. And he needed quite a bit of rehabilitation, and we're fortunate that we have a lot of wonderful volunteers that do all kinds of body work and Reiki and massage and chiropractic and so forth, and that these animals really appreciate the care and the safety. But the safety is the underlying, we find over and over again, component.
And it takes them probably a while, depending on how bad the abuse was before that, to get to a point where they do feel safe.
Yes, it does. It does. And you have to keep reassuring them of that. We spend a lot of time with each individual animal, and so it is also, our sanctuary does not have cages. It is family-style living. Of course, we have good fencing. And we have separate groups for instance, the small dogs and the bigger dogs.
And you don't put the dogs with the poultry.
No, we don't do that. We haven't gotten to that point yet.
where the lion lies down with the lamb.
Right. So we certainly, we're very safety conscious there, too, in terms of the species, of course. But they don't sit in cages. So, for instance, the dogs go along to the barns in the morning. There's lots of interesting smells and events that have happened during the night they have to check out. And so they get a lot of just motivated exercise that way, and they lead what we call an interesting life.
Well, that's very important for all animals, including the poultry.
It is.
You have it set up in such a way that on one end of the poultry area there's water, on the other end there's a little sort of man-made wetland, and the animals, the birds have to go back and forth, and so they're actually running around all day.
Right, they are. And we have the wetlands, and of course the water there, offers nurturing too for the trees around it. We have a lot of trees, a lot of natural vegetation. And the ducks and the geese and the chickens and the peacocks and so forth, they love the mud. Of course, we all know that they love the mud. And they go between the mud and they go down to the pool in the other end and rinse off, and they go back and forth all day. So they get a lot of exercise. And
now, horses, you've got a couple of horses at the Kindred Spirits Animal Sanctuary also. Do you find so many people treat their dogs badly. What about, did they treat their horses badly? Do they abuse and abandon them as well?
Yes. I think that in my experience with horses, horses suffer tremendously at the hands of people that often are not educated enough to work with horses and therefore turn to force. And it becomes a power struggle, which is always unwise to have with a horse, because that turns to severe gadgets and tools and so forth that people develop and purchase to, quote, control this large animal. And there are many, many very dangerous situations, too. But horses suffer tremendously because it takes a long time to develop a language, a working language, not just a cuddle language. But if people are actually, using the horses for, say, riding or packing or whatever, you have to develop a working language that the horse can understand and be comfortable with. And it takes a long time. And most people in our culture here, are not inclined to take the time. They want quick results. And it really is at the discomfort, the suffering of the horses. They're very misunderstood. And they're very, very powerful. So you quickly enter into a power struggle there.
So you've got a couple of horses there. How did they come to the sanctuary?
They actually came from private situations. They're both about 28 years old, and the one of them came to me many, many years ago. I have been doing this for many years out of my private means and working a lot of overtime.
As a nurse, as a bereavement counselor.
As a nurse primarily at the time, yes. Uh-huh. And one of them came to me many, many years ago, over 20 years ago, and was so crippled that he could not put his head to the ground and eat off the ground. And again, this was not necessarily that the people were treating him intentionally rough. I see it more as lack of education and lack of even knowing that this horse had was terribly crippled. The way that the people read it was that he was just not willing to perform what they wanted, and there was no connection there in terms of language or safety again. And so we see that a lot. I get a lot of calls for horses or people that... horses are considered a user animal in this culture, and so if a horse is not, quote, useful for people, they see it as useless in general. And my take on that, when people want to discard a horse because it is not useful, maybe it's a little old or it has gotten a little crippled on one leg or something. And if people proceed to tell me that they want to buy another horse or they really have the rooms and means for another horse, my take on that is usually in talking to people nicely to have them look at how they're raising their children, if they have children, because this could be a wonderful teaching model, how they want to be, as parents, want to be treated when they get a little up in the years and maybe they develop a little limp or they develop a little frailties. How would they like the children to treat them?
That hits home.
It does with a lot of people. A lot of people say, gee, I never thought of that.
And right.
So maybe we could stretch a little further. Maybe we could keep this horse as part of the family.
Right.
And also into an older age. So there are ways of beginning to shift the model, the paradigm, really, of how animals are in our lives.
So you do a huge amount, not only of taking care of animals, but of really educating and counseling people. That's a big part of your job.
It is. It is. And, of course, I have not been in anyone else's shoes, so I do not feel that I need to judge anybody. I mean, there are many very, very difficult situations out there, and but people don't have often anyone to talk to. It's a difficult thing.
And it's a culture that, as you say, first of all, is a throwaway culture. Second,
yes.
Doesn't respect age.
Right.
And third, doesn't really see that animals are alive in the way that humans are alive.
Right. Right. We still, unfortunately, have the legal language of ownership. And it's a difficult one to get around because it is so much in our subconscious of another something that we can purchase and dispose of. It's changing. It is definitely changing.
Now, you have seen that it's changing from what? From the types of phone calls you get? From
Yes, from the types of phone calls, people are beginning to become aware that we are in existence and there is such a thing. We're pretty much on the forefront in terms of caring for the elderly animals. And there are a few more such places in the United States, but in this area we are. And as people discover it, a lot of people come forward with interest in wanting to do different and better now than they maybe, say, did 10 years ago when they had a dying dog, a horse, or a feathered friend. And when I say better, I don't mean better as a value judgment, but they want to be more right with their own conscience and with their own heart and their own relationship they had with that animal in their lives. And that inspires them to go a little bit further and explore how else they could be with the end of life care, how they could do hospice, how they could reach out for help.
Well, reaching out for help, how do people do that?
Well, it's something that we certainly encourage them to do. We offer workshops, in our education, we offer workshops at the sanctuary, and in end-of-life care, in nutrition, in wellness care. And one of the things that we help them do when they leave the workshop is to develop support groups and how to go about that and how to develop a real good professional relationship with their healthcare providers for their animal, be it their traditional vet or other healthcare providers, and so that they can have that in place from early on. Of course, that keeps developing, but something that is part of their life with that animal, and so they don't wait until it becomes a crisis and nobody can think clearly when there's a crisis and then becomes a real problem, because I get calls from people often that say, well, if only I had known, if only I had had somebody to share this with, or my grief, or my distress. There was no time, there was nobody had time to listen, because it was an emergency at the time, and I don't even know what really went on. So helping people work through that grief is often compounded, and to give them a safe space to be with that grief and distress and help them to resolve that within themselves and find support. It can also be grief support groups, bereavement groups that we now have in the community, which is wonderful. And there are some that are especially addressing pet loss.
You know, there's a website called, I think it's petloss.com, and somebody sent me the link to it when my little dog Dugan died.
Yeah.
And there was a chat room, so I went into the chat room for about 5 minutes, and everybody was crying.
Chatting and crying.
It was very funny.
But, you know, it can be that, too, and it reminds me that it is so important to, in the midst of loss and grief and so forth, humor can really be a very, very healing component. And often people think, whoa, I wouldn't want to sit there and laugh with a stranger. But, you know, you'd be surprised what comes up, because it can be a whole, like, in a sense, chaos of feelings that need to be expressed. And all of a sudden you remember something funny that you had, you know, that you had with your little dog or something. And that comes up and wants to be expressed too. And tears are really very healing, very cleansing. And so at Kindred Spirits, we're not afraid of crying. I cry a lot, but it's okay.
Well, I mean, I would think here you are working in doggy, horsey, bird hospice. There's animals dying all the time.
Yeah.
I don't know how you do it.
It's okay. It's part of life. As well as laughter, tears are also part of life, and we feel our feelings, and it's really okay. For me, it would be a lot harder not to do, knowing that there's a real need, and seeing how many animals are in distress, dying in just feeling totally uncared for. And nevertheless, we keep on producing more and more animals, and we haven't gotten a real good handle yet in this culture on how to manage the population control in a caring way. And so people often, or I should say, these animals often produce sort of mindlessly just because it's cute to have a little puppy, if we're talking about dogs, and then pretty soon they grow out of that cute state, and they become kind of disposable for a lot of people. Certainly there are many wonderful, wonderful homes for animals and family situations, absolutely. But the ones that we tend to, or that come into our care, have been disposed of in one way or the other.
We're talking to Ulla Peterson of the Kindred Spirits Animal Sanctuary. On your grounds, you've had tremendous support from the community, including the Santa Fe Home Builders Association, many individuals, and you've set the grounds up in such a way that it's really green building and a whole sort of self-contained little ecosystem. Tell us about it.
Yes, well, personally, I've always lived that way, but certainly I want the Kindred Spirits Animal Sanctuary to be a sanctuary not only for the discarded animals coming in there, but also for the earthworms and for those that are tilling our underground and tend to our underground, all those little critters.
And your compost.
And our compost, absolutely. And the wild birds that come in. We have a lot of wild birds that come in also. And and of course, I also wanted to be a sanctuary for people coming in there. And for instance, people with chemical sensitivities can usually work there very well because we don't use toxins or harsh chemicals, anything like that. So it's ecologically very sound, as much as we possibly can. And we compost and recycle everything, as you said, and just have a light impact living. That's what we seek.
And you also teach workshops. People can come out there. What kind of workshops do you teach?
They're half-day workshops, and they are generally geared towards adults. And they are on things that relate to the elder care. We have an excellent nutritional program, friends, and we teach about that. And we teach about end-of-life care, and that pertains to the whole realm of end-of-life care. So it includes the guardian of the animals, too, in what they're going through. We look at what is normal aging, what is not normal. We teach good assessment
What's
skills.
Not normal?
Well, not normal could be, for instance, a disease process. It could be an accident. It could be, you know, things that interfere with, it could be some genetic
okay.
that could be interfering with the normal aging.
So things to watch for.
Right, right.
And also, what for people's own end of life, when people are older, they really need to know what to do with their pets after they themselves, the people, right. pass on.
Right, right. Another workshop that we are planning to teach this fall, and the dates have not been set yet, but is on estates, on wills and estate planning, and which is a huge issue that also for younger people. I mean, people could have an accident or whatever. And
I made my living will a long time ago.
Good, good. Yeah, yeah. And we all should, really. And you feel much better. And but I wanted to say also that the people that participate in our workshops on end-of-life care, although our focus is on the animals, it doesn't stop there because they go home and think about their own aging process, wherever they are in the spectrum. They all of a sudden start thinking more about the elderly and their family, maybe in the neighborhood, and it becomes a much larger experience for them and something that they can be present with as opposed to not being present with and feeling like they have to go into denial or split off. Or so that is, we really are teaching not to, our teaching is geared towards being accepting and honoring and being with as opposed to not being able to cope, going into denial, and so forth. So it's not to make it easy. It's never easy, but it becomes doable and becomes something that's inclusive in life. And
is part of the whole cycle of
yes,
life.
Yes, yes, it is.
Now, there is an art show this weekend at the Kindred Spirits Animal Sanctuary. It's from 10 to 4 this Saturday, the 28th of July. And you, Carol Olson, are going to be showing your paintings. And you are an incredible animal painter.
Thank you.
Painter of portraitist, I guess, of animals. Including some of the animals at the sanctuary.
Right.
And you do commissions for people's own pets.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yes, I do. I love doing the animals. I think I do people as well. But after I visited the sanctuary, just getting to know all the animals out there and their personalities, and they're so beautiful, and their eyes express so much, I thought, oh, I'd love to do these guys. They're great, especially, you know, like Salvador. He's one of my very favorites, and he smiles. You take a picture of him, and it looks like he's smiling.
Smiling dogs.
Absolutely. And our poster boy here, Little Bit Buddha, is just
whose picture is here at the Santa Fe Bacon Company proudly displayed.
yes, he's getting a lot of attention, even though he's not here in person. So, I mean, they're all such characters, and they all have such individual personalities.
And the you will be selling your paintings, and a portion of that those sales will go
yes.
to Kindred Spirits. This is also a chance for people to see the sanctuary and just experience that the life out there.
Yes. Yes, it is. It's a wonderful time for people to visit, really. We get we invite families to come out. It's very family-friendly. And people can take their time. They can sit down someplace, and we serve, of course, refreshments. They can take their time with visiting with the animals, and we will have volunteers there. And it's just a nice time to visit. There's lots of shade. And
there's lots of shade. It's amazing because it's out there in the blazing sun, but you've constructed it in such a way that there's lots of cool little
right.
areas to sit down. You're also always looking for volunteers.
Yes, yes. We're always looking for volunteers. Our volunteers are mostly with us in the morning from 8 to 1, but it certainly could be other times too. And obviously, with the kind of work we're doing, working with the elderly, and it's important that people have a sense of caring for the elderly and are patient and loving with them, because it's a little bit of a slowed down work. We do a lot of what we call Russian cuddle. Of course, we do feeding and cleaning and putting a lot of miles in the vacuum cleaner. But
miles on the vacuum cleaner. And all of this is happening at the Kindred Spirits Animal Sanctuary. The number there, if people want to find out more, is 471-5366. They're on the web at kindredspiritsnm.org. And they are on Highway 14 going south out of Santa Fe, and people can get the addressed by calling or by visiting the website.
They could, and it's also on the telephone, yeah. And it is half a mile south of the Lone Butte General Store.
That's right.
On the right side, and there will be signs and balloons when you get close.
So this is Saturday from 10 to 4. Ulla Peterson and Carol Olson, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate it, Ms. Charlotte. Thank you.
We're going to take a break right now. When we come back, we'll be speaking with the residents from Santa Fe Art Institute. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Gabe Gomez, who is with the Santa Fe Art Institute, and artist Peter Williams and writer Lainey Zumas. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Morning.
Tell us, Gabe, quickly about the residence program at the Santa Fe Art Institute. We've had residents on here before.
It's a big part of the Santa Fe Art Institute, where we host artists from all over the world from a month to 3 months to, give them an opportunity to work on their, visual art, their writing, or any other medium that they work in. And, every month we have an open studio.
That open studio is today?
Today at 4 o'clock at the Art Institute. And we're going to have a blend of both writers and visual artists talking about their work, and we're going to have readings and a little studio tour and refreshments and all that fun stuff.
Now, Peter Williams, you're a painter.
Yes.
Oil painter, acrylic.
Oil.
And
the work, I think of myself as kind of a storyteller. The work is narrative. It deals with the traditional forms, allegory, narratives, portraiture, things of that sort. The current work is about the Iraq War, and it's part of a series called The Green Zone. So it's a series of portraits of heads, and right now most of them have been like the wounded and so forth. Other times the work has been about people like Condoleezza Rice or Dick Cheney, things of that sort.
I think it's very important for artists to be responding to political events, to the Iraq War, to the world we live in, to the incredible drain on our nation's resources. And yet, presumably, you have not been there, or have you?
I have not been there. I look like I've been there, but I've not been there. I am from the battle of having gone to school in Albuquerque 40 years ago, and my roommate drove us off a cliff in the Sandia Mountains.
And you lost a leg.
And I lost a leg.
Good heavens.
So there's a little bit of empathy there, partly by way of the fact through the 70s, a lot of people mistook me for a Vietnam vet. Of which I wasn't. And so I guess now I'm sort of channeling that experience of the disabled veteran in this work. And I guess to a certain degree the work is somewhat autobiographical in that sense. I paint about things that are allegorical, but they may refer in the end to my life experience.
Very interesting. When you, I was there yesterday. You weren't at the Art Institute, but I got a little chance to see your studio and some of the work there. And it's always a question for me when people who are painters do narrative work, doesn't have words in it. How explicit do you feel that you have to be in order for people to understand the nature of the narrative?
Well, I think it's very hard to get a viewer's attention under any circumstances. I try to make the paintings as suggestive as possible. I think once they enter into that pictorial space, it's up to them to decide whether or not they want to go further with it. I think generally speaking, when you're not using words and text and language and so forth, it's a much slower medium to work in. And I don't consider my work to be mass appeal. You have to be somewhat interested in painting. You have to be somewhat interested in standing there and deciphering all the coding that I put in. It's a portrait, but it's not a traditional portrait. It deals with issues of distortion and representation. And so I elicit a pretty strong response from viewers at times. In some of the larger paintings where there are multi-figures and so forth, I use more pop oriented kinds of characters, kind of cartoony in some cases, or they deal with cultural identity issues and stereotype, Mammy and Sambo and things of that sort, or their derivations of over time.
Where do you live normally when you're not here?
I live in a, it's called Delaware. I refer to it as Del Unaware. It's a difficult place to live, but it's also, I'm, you know, 55, and I'm ready to live in a suburb that's safe and convenient after 20 years in Detroit, which had a big influence on the kind of cultural imagery and ideas that the work evolved through. I kind of saw myself as a storyteller telling the story of a post-industrial medieval village, only it was Detroit.
Only it was Detroit.
Right.
What's the art scene like in Detroit?
It's really vibrant. Amazingly enough, it has a very strong visual arts community, a collecting base, galleries. Certainly it goes through its ups and downs. But it's also, there's a lot of writers there and musicians. So you have this kind of inchoate discussion going on that probably revolves around a kind of post-industrial mindset, either through the way people look at the world or express themselves, or just try to deal with the practical realities that Detroit is the future. And a lot of Europeans, especially Germans, spend a lot of time coming to Detroit because of that.
The Germans are just a step ahead, ladies and gentlemen.
Heard here first.
We're talking to Peter Williams, who is not to be confused with KSFR's own Peter Williams, who's a tremendous DJ who actually has a show on the air tonight at 10 o'clock called Music in the Madness. Let's turn to Leni Zumas. She is a writer, and you are here working on a novel.
I am, yeah. I came to the Institute with about 300 pages of a novel that I would love to finish a draft of this summer, and I'm really grateful for the time and the space to kind of plunge into it. I mean, one of the things about longer-form fiction is that it means creating a world that I, as the writer, live in for a long time, you know, multiple years, and it's very difficult. I teach, like Peter, during the year, and I'm having to constantly interrupt my work with course planning and teaching and dealing with students. It makes it much more challenging.
And so a residency program is like a godsend.
It is. I love residencies, and this one's great, because not only do we have this great privacy and space for ourselves, but we're in a gorgeous setting. You know, I look out of my window and see a sky that I do not see in Brooklyn, New York, where I live. And it changes things. I mean, I think, and it's also a testimony to the seriousness that we all bring to our work, that we're here in a community kind of working all day, and then in the evenings, if we're sharing a meal or whatever, we talk about what we're working on, and there's a huge amount of cross-pollination that goes on. You know, I particularly enjoy experiencing the work of the artist, the visual artist, because I talk to writers all the time in my regular life, but here I get to look at a painting and be curious about why someone made choices that he made or she made.
A friend of mine who is a writer went to a residency once, and she said she learned a great deal from the painters,
yeah,
because they threw out so much of what they did or painted over it, whereas yeah, writers tend to hang on to every little word they scribble on a piece of paper as if it were a gem, when often it yeah, just needs to be thrown out.
Yeah, no, it's true. I mean, it's a different way of working, but so many of the concerns are the same, you know. How do you reach another human being with your work? You know, as Peter said, most people don't even take the time to stand in front of a painting for 2 seconds. Or how do you get someone to read past the first page of what you're making?
What's your novel about?
I'm writing about an almost famous punk band that broke up after the sudden death of its guitar player. There was a sort of accident and a hidden sort of hidden circumstances of a tragedy, and the book opens 10 years after the fact, when a video channel lackey comes to, he's making a documentary about great failures of the early 90s, and so he wants to get the singer, the former singer, to be on board, but the singer has no interest in making this movie because he wants to hide the circumstances of the guitar player's death. And so the book is also kind of about the consequences of not wanting to grow up, of people who are declining to adapt and change and stretch in their lives, and, you know, people who, like this singer, are in their mid to late 30s and really wish they were still 20 years old and with the urgency and glory of their life then.
We don't have a whole lot of time, but would you like to read just a little bit out of your novel?
Sure. I'll read just a scene where, from the beginning, which is when the singer Zed Greaves is in bed and the rockumentary maker comes to his house. He blinks at a bar of sun quivering on the radiator. The walls are the color of the lining of his throat. Nothing hangs from them. Last month, in a frenzy, he tore everything down. The flyers, the photographs, all evidence of that vanished life. He shuts his eyes and folds his knuckles between aching legs. What is it, Thursday? His day off. The girl in bed beside him, whose tastes are borrowed from other people, will want to go eat overpriced toast. A closer, a smaller bell. Baby, she says, the door. Settle down, he says. But we should get it. Leave it, he tells her. It's Thursday. Clouds move in his forehead and the date flies up to his eyes, February 15th. Again, the shrilling, more insistent. Probably Jehovah's Witnesses, he says. They love this neighborhood. Because of all the black people, she asks. Are you kidding me, he says. I'm getting it, she shrugs. 10 years ago, the crash, a decade to the day. It was fast and white and falling, and then it was darker, and then it was gone. He checked his throat for blood. He closed, he opened his eyes. He felt for pain where there was none. When the others yelled, are you alive? He said, yes, and there was no blood in his mouth. The girl is back. She perches in the doorway, fingering a reel of plum-colored hair. Zed, I think you should come out. Seriously, baby, it's a director. A what? He wants to make a movie about you. Well, you and the others. The Ides of February, a decade ago. Zed sits up and swallows, but no blood. The girl adds, he said I could be in it. Gee. And you'll get famous, she says. I thought I already was, he says. The night they met, whiskey tongues and itchy hands under a chandelier at the afternoon bar, she gurgled, Zed Greaves? Oh my God, you're famous. But you have to remind people now, she says, backing slowly out of the room. I'll bring him in. If you bring him into this house, I'll do you a serious mischief. This isn't a house, she says. He shakes the pack on the floor by the bed. You have any cigarettes? Raising his voice to coax the vomit back down to his stomach. The girl answers, I do if you come out. Briefly, he enjoys the ideas of his fingers sunk into the meat of her mouth, crushing it shut, plugging her nostrils until she drowns.
Leni Zumas. And Leni Zumas will be reading tonight from, it's between 4 and 6 this evening at the Santa Fe Art Institute?
Yes.
And Peter Williams will be showing his work and other artists as well.
Uh-huh. Yeah, we begin at 4. We'll do some readings with Leni and some other writers. We have 4 this time. And then 5 visual artists. And, free refreshments, open to the public. Should be
free
a lot of fun.
Refreshments.
Come on.
We'll be there. Santa Fe Art Institute is on the campus of the College of Santa Fe, right on St. Michael's Drive. You go in the driveway, you go all the way down to the end and park, and it's right there.
It's right there, the beautiful red stucco building with the pointy things on top.
And there's the show Comfort Zone is there as well.
Absolutely, yes.
Well, that is all for now. Thank you so much, Peter, Leni, and Gabe for being with us.
Thanks
very much.
We're going to take another little break, and when we come back, we'll be hearing from Women's Health Services. Stay tuned. I'd like now to welcome Christy Wickman. She's a certified family nurse practitioner at Women's Health Services right here in Santa Fe. Welcome to KSFR.
Thanks a lot.
You are doing a program specifically for teenage people, teenage girls.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about it.
Well, we are starting a pilot project to do a group visit with young girls who need their physicals for going back to school. Actually, I shouldn't say young girls. We're really targeting teenagers, 16 to 18.
I love it when people say young girls when they actually mean young women.
They do. But I think I don't know what they want to be called exactly. Is it teenager? Is it young woman? So either is fine with me. Some feel like they're teenagers still. Some feel like they're young women. So,
now, what's different about this project than any young person coming in and getting a physical?
Well, usually what happens with a physical is, you know, the teenager signs up for a physical, comes with their parent, and they have their physical, and we fill out forms for school or sports or whatever, and they go away. So this one is a little bit different in that we're having all the girls who need them, a group of girls in that age range, 16 to 18, come at the same time. They'll have a private physical, and if they need a pap smear or STD testing, we'll do that at the same time. And then after that, there will be a group visit. And in that group visit will be all the teenage girls, and we'll be talking about oh, we'll be talking about STDs, we'll be talking about the human papillomavirus. A lot of girls have questions about the vaccine and how it's transmitted. We'll be talking about nutrition, we'll be talking about body image, various topics like that, some that we'll bring to the table and some that hopefully they'll have questions. Because our intention is that when there is a group of girls together or young women of this age range, they probably have as many questions that they can generate with each other.
Have you seen that happen? Have you seen girls, teenage girls, start talking about things with each other that they really wouldn't talk about one-on-one with a doctor or nurse?
It does happen. You know, I run some different projects, especially for the conference Girls Rock each year, and I do one around sexuality and sexually transmitted diseases. And the kind of conversation that gets generated just between themselves is amazing. It really starts to kind of catch fire, and they ask things they might not if it was just myself and them.
What are some examples of those topics?
Well, sometimes they'll say, I'll ask just a generic question like, so what do you do if a guy wants to have sex and you don't? What can you guys say? How can you respond to that? And they start coming up with their own ideas, and then they laugh and giggle and some, well, I heard this, and my friend tried this or whatever. And so it generates something in and among themselves more than it might just with me because they have their peers there.
Do secrets that are maybe not so nice that they haven't told people tend to come out in those settings?
Maybe, maybe not. You know, in a group setting, of course, there's a lot more vulnerability and a lot more, conformity. You know, they want to be more like one another. So that generally would come out in a private visit, something that was a little scarier or something around abuse or anything like that. I don't know that they would feel safe in that environment. But we do know that education that they receive together as a group can be quite powerful.
And so this is happening at Women's Health?
Well, we've tried it in other formats before. We've done it with patients who have diabetes, for example. We've done it with prenatal care, which was highly successful. Both of those were highly successful because they could really share their experiences with one another in a way that the provider, the physician or nurse practitioner, isn't their peer. You know, we're really in a place of authority rather than a peer. So it was really successful. This is the first time to do the teen physicals in this format.
How do people get involved if mothers or fathers of, mm-hmm. of teenage girls are listening, or the girls themselves?
What they would do is call Women's Health Services. I should say right off the bat, they do not need to be a patient at Women's Health Services. If they are, that's fine. If they're not, that's fine. This pilot project is completely free, so it would be a free physical for these young women, free STD testing, free pap smear, free group visit. They would call Women's Health Services and indicate that they want to do the group visit with the physical included.
And the number over there is?
988-8869.
And that's Women's Health Services. Christy Wickman, thank you so much for being with us and telling us all about it. I'm sorry we didn't have more time.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at the email radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting. My website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want to listen at thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and it will show up in your iTunes every single day, ladies and gentlemen. KSFR is moving up the dial to 101.1 FM. Retune your radios if you haven't already. 101.1 is our new home. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And thanks, by the way, to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Let's see. Good Morning Jazz is next with John Greenspan. And not sure what he's going to be playing today because I've lost my little note that says. I'm sorry. But broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. Tomorrow, Robert Knott will be with us, speaking of the arts, and much, much more. So keep your dial tuned to KSFR, Santa Fe's only public radio station. Hasta la vista.